And my name's James. And welcome to the complete first season of the Graffiti Research Lab. I was kind of a skater kid growing up, so that was kind of my destructive hobby. And then when I came to New York City, like most art master students who first arrive in the city, they do their first five or six projects either on the subway or on graffiti. And so I picked graffiti as the one that I was kind of interested in. So I was just as a documentarian, a photographer of it. The Graffiti Research Lab was a project that started at iBeam, and in particular in this lab at iBeam called the Open Lab. And the Open Lab's a kind of somewhere between a research lab in the tradition of kind of MIT or something and an art residency. The only thing that's kind of particular specific to the Open Lab is this idea of open source work. So when the lab was started, Jonah Peretti and Mike Fruman, they just wanted to make a lab where people could come and work free from sort of all the obstacles that copyright and patents throw up in front of communities. So the Open Lab was a bit of an experiment, and we were in the inaugural year of this sort of grand public domain experiment. Yeah, and before iBeam, I'd also gone to kind of a digital art technology school, but gotten sort of less interested in making art projects and was more interested in the tech side. So I actually kind of scammed my way into a job working for a government contractor and was part of the team that developed this thing called the rock abrasion tool that was a device that would help the Mars rover grind into rocks. At the same time, kind of my off time, I was making these sort of little robotic projects. One in particular that I put on Coney Island was a glacier that would move really, really slowly. It was a robotic glacier and measure CO2 levels. But that's when I sort of got interested at seeing technologies in public spaces and seeing people interact with these sort of high-tech systems as opposed to the ones that, you know, live remotely on some other planet for their entire existence. So we passed around links of our work to each other, and I saw some of Evan's graffiti analysis project, and I'd already heard Explicit Lyrics Only and a few other works, and I was kind of just struck by the fact that, you know, their documentation, the use of kind of like cool music and video work was kind of moving in this direction that I had been interested in going myself, which was just finding a way that my projects didn't kind of die on some beach in Coney Island, but had some kind of life afterwards on the internet. And I'd made some videos and they weren't really working out yet. You know, I still hadn't really gotten people to look at it. And when I saw his, I realized, oh, you just have to add a hip hop track. But I told you about this paint, this conductive paint that existed that I'd seen in my former vocation. And I always thought, you know, we'd eventually see these graffiti writers who were spraying conductive paint down and making circuits on walls and adding light and sound and whatever else kinetic shit into their work. And I just never saw it. And so I thought, well, this isn't going to really come across unless I just make this thing and show it to like the rest of the people in the lab and show Evan what it looks like, and then maybe from there something will happen. And they wouldn't let us do it in the sort of main space. They sent me to the garbage hallway. So I was back there with the garbage and junk, but I still couldn't spray aerosol during the day. I had to wait till it was night. So once everyone left the building, I stayed up all night and I made this shit. Hooked up the circuitry, turned it on, and went home. And then the next day I didn't come in. I just called Evan and Jonah and the rest of the people in the lab, and I was like, hey, go check the back hallway. And at that time, I thought it was kind of funny to be in the back hallway, so I'd actually sprayed a stencil on the wall that said graffiti research. And I just sort of said, joking around, go back to the graffiti research lab and check out what we're doing. And so those guys went back there and saw it, and they were like, what the fuck is this? Yeah, but it was literally when the New York Times came and we were like, well, we want to show them the garbage hallway. And they were like, well, there's something kind of weird about that because, you know, it looks like we're hiding it. And I'm like, well, you are. And that probably would look weird. And they were like, well, I guess you could do something on the front of the building. And before the period had been hit on that sentence, I was already out in the front of the building putting GRL on front of I-beam. That's when the takeover began. Through our process of research, we got to see the work of a bunch of artists who were doing the same type of thing that we had been doing with technology, this type of hacker mentality, meaning they were taking systems that already exist and trying to find the easiest way in to create the biggest output effect. There are a lot of graffiti writers and street artists that are already doing this. Someone who'll take a feature or landform that's already in the city and change it slightly, add another replica of it, or in some way modify the city so that everything changes. You kind of can't see it the same. And he's a graffiti technologist too. And he uses packaging tape basically to clone any three-dimensional thing in the city. You wrap it in tape, cut the tape off, bring it back to your house, and you've got a fire hydrant or a lamppost or a phone or whatever. You've just cloned something in the public space, and now you can take it back, reinsert it, modify it, play around with it. As much as a physical history of graffiti, there's an oral history of graffiti. The web's a perfect place for this oral history, and it's really thrived on the web from sites like 12 Ounce Profit and Worcester Collective to Flickr and Photolog and all over the world. We've all gotten introduced into each other's work, and now this oral history has a slideshow behind it. Just like the trains moved it all over New York City, the internet moves it all over the planet. There's a lot of Luddite graffiti artists, and it's totally a legitimate fear. And we are also technophobic, which is something that doesn't often get conveyed about our work. Relative to traditional graffiti, it is more high-tech. But relative to the state of the art, it is considerably lower-tech than your average sort of technology art project. We both worked in very high-tech fields, and we left those jobs, and we didn't get fired, right? We, ran as fast as we fucking could from our our corporate technology jobs because we had a growing fear of a type of technological mainstream that was scary as fuck. I mean, I was working for the Department of Defense on military contracts, and I couldn't believe what people were designing technologies to do. And Evan was watching buildings being erected, you know, and seeing cities sort of become these overdeveloped, saturated consumer media space. And we have a lot of peers, engineer, architects, friends who were like, you know what, this is a neutral space we work in where we're developing things. They could be used for good, they could be used for bad, but that's not our decision. You know, we're the engineers. We're the architects. You know, we're kind of the front end of this. Let someone else determine how they're going to be used. And for me, when I was working on the Department of Defense type projects, it was clear to me that these weren't neutral projects. Any tool that's made to harm somebody, they're always kind of bad, or at least they're always powerful enough to be abused. So with graffiti and an idea of a lab devoted to graffiti, I mean, it seemed obvious to us that what we were doing was something that, you know, they weren't neutral. We thought they were good. The other guys thought they were bad. You know, there wasn't much of a middle ground. Not just people who are writing sort of big letters on trains with spray cans, but also protesters and activists who were doing things in public. And, you know, this sort of hacktivist culture that we had seen growing, who were combining technology and public space with agendas. They were hacking urban spaces in order to talk about whatever is important to them. I mean, this is all around the same time as the Republican National Convention here in New York City. So this idea of the city as a contested territory was in all our minds. Post-9/11 sort of mentality in New York City forced everyone to start thinking a little bit differently about their city, almost as like an occupied city. Evan continued his work using graffiti writer's tags as a data source. We came up with a larger scale way to capture a graffiti writer's tag plus the drip. Theo was also a production fellow here at iBeam, so we got to work with him for about 6 months before we kind of realized that probably we could collaborate on something together. Theo's our programmer, audio, video type specialist. He's written a lot of software for us, in particular the software for the laser tag system. So yeah, so every once in a while we got to do larger projects in the in that first sort of 6 month period. We went to Maker Faire. We went and got a school bus, painted it like SWAT team black, and did our electrograph work on it. But then thought, why don't we just open this bus up? You know, we have some markers, let people just ride on it. People who would normally hate graffiti here getting a chance to kind of be a part of it. And they would say things like, I'm a middle-aged housewife and I've never done this before. It's a lot of fun. Slowly but surely, it would dawn on people who were riding on this bus what was kind of fun about graffiti. So we'd get stuck in these events where we'd be doing workshops with groups of thousands of kids. We kind of realized, oh, this is actually also a way to do kind of a graffiti outreach program, train the graffiti writers of the future. An LED throwy consists of an LED, a battery, a magnet, and tape. You combine those all together in a process that is nearly self-explanatory, and you can toss that onto a ferrous metal structure, and they stick. All the materials for throwies were sitting in the lab on a table because they were the same materials that we use in the electrograph. And one of the parts that Evan was most interested in about the electrograph is the mechanism of attachment, you know, having a magnet stick to something. It was both fast and it seemed for a city like New York sort of versatile. There's a lot of structures that could go up on and you could throw it up really, really high and it would stick. We thought we were lucky in that first night that a group of like school age kids, some little like hooligan kids came walking by. And we thought, wow, it was really lucky that we had these kids come by who kind of already understood. One of the kids yelled, yo, they bombing it. And they drew all these other people into it and whatnot. But it turned out that it wasn't just luck that that would happen whoever walked by. If it was a group of like Japanese businessmen that had walked by or a delegation of senators or whoever. You throw up a throwy, girls start taking their bras off, and, you know, throwies just start hitting shit, and everyone gets into it equally. It was just a demonstration of the fact that this open source thing wasn't just a generous sharing of our intellectual property, but that this shit was going to make us famous. Within the first 3 days, there was already a modification of throwies that was reposted on the web. I think it was that first one by that guy, Everything's Digital. He had done a Flickr set that showed how to make an on-off tab. Maybe a week later, you had someone making a motion-sensitive throwy. And a week after that, you had another type of throwy. A woman who had been doing a bunch of taxidermy projects actually combined the throwy project with taxidermy and made the rat throwy, which were magnets embedded inside of a taxidermied rat with LEDs in the eyes, and you could turn it on and actually toss it on a car or whatever, and this rat would stick to it. The first month, let's say, there was something like 13 different modifications. Suddenly you started seeing that movement up where people were adding functionality. DIY sites were starting to call throwies a platform. We'd started in the open lab because we wanted to be evangelists for open source. And Ward Cunningham is one of these names to us that's prominent because he introduced the world to the concept of a wiki. And we met him and he saw throwies and he liked them. And he actually made a modification with his son, Pat. It's like a throwy with a little bump of a computer stuck into it that blinks Morse code. And it would blink the entire wiki page for the search term graffiti. Normal dudes, people in their hometown supporting their soccer team, dudes wearing them on their ears, noses. Yeah, drinking some beers in Arizona. People using them as a substitute for rice at their wedding. Marriage proposals have occurred in throwies. People started talking about it in The Voice, you know, and they said that it was the realization of Hakeem Bey's turnip. It was the manifestation of the internet actually sharing physical quantities. So people trumped it a lot, and it got more hype than it probably deserved. The project was sort of so simple, no one felt like they owned it. People were like, oh, did you go to Gasworks Parks in Seattle? And I'm like, I've never been to Seattle. And they're like, oh, I saw throwies there. These things were happening all over. Video, audio, photos. You know, it made it actually interesting. Every time we did a presentation, we could just go to any one of these sort of Web 2.0 sites and do a search for the throwies tag. And we'd find 25 new photos every time. There were some artists that got in touch with us who wanted to do projects with us. Artists like Mark Jenkins, we'd been a fan of his work, and he had seen some of our stuff, so he contacted us and said, let's collaborate on some project. He was the first artist who said, okay, I get it. You guys are like the lab that makes James Bond's tools for him, and I'm going to be James Bond in this instance. I have these tape sculptures of these forms. I think that lights would look good inside them. Can you guys facilitate that? So basically, Mark came to town. We showed him how to make a throwy. We made a few hundred with him. And then he did all the rest, found ways to embed them into his work, came up with a system to kind of hang them inside it. Yeah, and appropriately, it was Jesus 2.0, the second coming. These like Jesus clones that he had made that were filled with LEDs. And so not only did we get to work with him on the technology side, we went out with him. We put these up, a few of them all over the city. We documented it. We made our video. You know, it was the same sort of process. Like you were saying, that Martha Cooper thing was there too. I mean, we were there in the street with him photographing his work, but it wasn't about us. It was about him. The project was so his that the fact that he had used something like throwies, which some people might think had a signature kind of quality to them, to us, but they didn't. We were kind of glad to see that he could totally take them over. It wasn't a GRL project. It was just pure Mark Jenkins. It wasn't just artists who were seeing this, too. Initially, when we did the how-to, we linked up this company, HB Electronics, a Chinese company. They noticed that we had linked them up, and they began sending us emails. This is interesting what you're doing. We kept ordering from them because they were the cheapest guys in town. And before long, they had made a page on their site that was dedicated to throwy packs. And actually, we're also selling batteries in addition to the LEDs. Yeah. Throwies received as much bad press as good press, and a lot of the bad press was around this issue of sustainability and the fact that we were putting throwaway electronics and the batteries wouldn't last for that long and they would also potentially leak chemicals. And from our perspective, we were thinking there is kind of an input-output ratio that's not really justified. There's not enough content to justify maybe the expense. And we'd actually been thinking about how to do it since the early days of throwaway events. You know, how can you write text with throwaways? We had some ideas, but we finally kind of perfected a system where you just combine some goods that you can buy at the Home Depot, foam core, a big painter's pole, edger attachments. You put it together with some glue. We use the laser cutter to cut out all these holes. But basically, you'd make this device where you could write really quickly, really high dot matrix style text in LED throwaways. Basically, every time we write with it, it's incomplete. It's not perfect. It looks kind of sketchy. And in a way, that is sort of appealing to us. Even the fact that the LEDs are flickering, it kind of has an older sign quality, but it looks like an advertisement nonetheless. Even when things are busted about it, it has that same kind of authority because it's lit. You could also put them 20 feet in the air. We put it up in some really high places, and it stayed there for a long time. It says Crime 2.0 on the West Side Rail Yard. Yeah. No, there's definitely some places where it'll stay for a while. People wanted us to come and, you know, use the Knight Rider to advertise. Come to Berlin for vodka companies or from Brazil for some other lifestyle magazine or something. It was clear that people saw that there was some advertising potential to these tools early on when they started selling them. But then they want to sell to young people because they're a really big buying demographic. And young people like to see people misbehaving, especially in public space. So MTV straight copied in the exact same style as the initial throwaway video. They made a commercial. It wasn't even really trying to sell anything as much as kind of a little, almost like a little bonus footage for Australia's MTV channel. And that was funny, and for me, that was much less disgusting than the also Christmas-type use that Coca-Cola did, where they turned a big metal Christmas tree on in Times Square, and it was Times Square, Hong Kong, and it was spinning around, and a bunch of kids all sort of synchronously threw LED throwaways onto it. One kid sort of holds one, like, close to his heart and closes his eyes like he's making a wish, and then opens them up and tosses it. So maybe they had some insane instructions. Yeah, I just didn't know they celebrated Christmas in China. I mean, I thought about that the other day. Do they? I mean, who is that for? They also had that band, the I Love You Boys, who are like some just saccharine shit Japanese boy band crap. They wrote I Love You Boys and some version of the Knight Rider on the Christmas tree, or I Love You, I think is what they wrote, and then performed in front of it, too. It was this fucking spectacle. Yeah, no, it's too bad. Yeah, I definitely would have made the trip. And then it all culminated in the now infamous Boston Terror Mind Shred 2007.
I'll never forget.
That day was pretty for real for us. It was like we knew about September 11th before it happened. We were like on the 70th floor of Tower 1 of the Boston Terror Mind Shred. You know, we were like right there. And they related it to LED throwies as well. Yeah. Also, he titled the photo, "Look What I Stole,"
right.
And then which was a nice touch. Yeah, he tagged it GRL and Graffiti Research Lab. No, he didn't think we did it. He was just making the connection to the inspiration. I mean, this guy, Todd Vanderlyn, by the way, he's also the first person to ever be detained and ticketed for throwies. Sort of like the character in the film noir, always returning to the scene of the crime with respect to geek graffiti projects. Yeah, we displayed it all over the world. Some good stuff. So Vanderlyn, he actually got in his Flickr comments to one of the photos. The marketing guy, whose name is Sam Travis Ewan, he wrote him a comment because he's trying to be down because he wants this to blow up on the internet. And so he's like, "Hey, Vanderlyn, good still," or whatever, "good pinch. If you think that's cool, check out this video." And the video was a video made by this guy named Peter Badofsky and his friend, who I don't care what his name is. The YouTube clip was interesting because it was also done kind of in our style. It was pretty good. It was fun to watch. It says, you know, inspired by the, maybe I'm quoting here, "brilliant creativity of the Graffiti Research Lab." Todd forwarded it to us, along with the communication with the guy from this company called Interactive Inc. that was like, "Oh, you know the GRL. Well, I challenged them to figure out how we did this." I didn't really understand what that meant, so I wasn't really interested, but we did download the YouTube clip because we thought this will be something we put in a proposal, right?
Yeah.
Some time elapsed between this event and an email I got one morning where Todd had written to me, "Have you heard about what's happening in Boston? These Moonanite advertisements have been discovered by some transit authority worker." The transit authority worker had called the police and the Homeland Security Department came in and they basically treated these like they were bombs and they defused them. There were a number of them all over the city, something like 20. And then he wrote back a few minutes later, "I'm fucked. They think I did it." I think he said, "We're fucked. I just got a call from the FBI." After telling Todd to basically just tell whoever called him, the FBI, the cops, the CIA, Department of Homeland Security, the ISI, just tell whoever it was that they needed to talk to Sam Travis Ewan. We had already looked up his company. And we had the address of it, and I think we forwarded him all that information. Just said, rat him out. Yeah. Yeah, it's Cameron's influence. I mean, stop snitching has kind of influenced me a little bit. But I still think it's true. It's never wrong to rat out a grill advertiser in practice. Fuck 'em. We got a lot of hits that day, and that's probably the only good thing that came out of that entire thing. I feel like the Department of Homeland Security is utterly incompetent. Things like this demonstrate how completely fucking vulnerable we are. Small glowing bombs that are on like a 1 month timer that depict pop culture symbols. If that's the type of device that they think people are going to put up in the city, we're fucked. Someone's going to pull a car up in front of the World Trade Center in Boston and blow the fucker up. And the cops are going to be digging around for Adult Swim ads. In some ways, this was the first shot across the bow from advertisers that, you know what? Not only do we own this city, literally we own physical spaces where we can put up anything we want to sell our product, but now we own all the spaces. We will go up everywhere. We will go over every public piece of property on train stations, on overpasses. We're going to adopt all the rules of graffiti artists to terrorize you, literally terrorize you, to stop traffic for hours and hours in your city. It's a war now. And so that was maybe the first time we were like, you know what, let's take a side in this war. And it's perfect that they're bringing it kind of to our turf. instead of working with advertisers the way so many graffiti crews do, if we all worked against those advertisers, we could probably diminish our chances of getting in trouble, because people don't give a fuck if you write on an ad. But also we could really do something to cut down on that one crew who's really all city now, which is the fucking advertisers, Guerrilla and Legal. And it's a shame, right, that in the city that birthed graffiti, that that's who's up the most. If you got stopped at all for doing it, they would just ask you to take it down, and you could immediately and show no damage was there. You could be bold enough to put it up anywhere, even very prominent ones in the middle of the city while people were walking around. Interestingly enough, Steve's message was received somewhat ambiguously. Some people thought it was actually an anti-graffiti statement, or more just like an anti-anything-in-public statement, because it was saying graffiti and advertising are both wrong. But ultimately, that is the position we take too, right? Graffiti is illegal. We don't want to see it legalized. We might, like a lot of people, advocate the decriminalization of it so that people aren't going to jail for a year sentence for a crime that would take one stroke of a brush to undo, but we're not for it being legal. So maybe that was the first time we had this notion that graffiti is illegal. Let's keep it that way. Let's make advertising illegal also. We know they'll still try to get up. Get off our wall. Occasionally we get to work with writers who, you know, are out right now, street bombers who we respect, who we work with to make more conventional tools. You'll never hear really anybody talk about them as much, but sometimes these are the ones where we feel like we're actually doing the work we set out to do the most effectively, because they're tools that are made for graffiti writers. They get used by graffiti writers. Our name's less associated with it. It's their work that's on display. So one of those writers is Katsu. He's kind of been someone who's willing to test drive some of the tools we've made out in the street. And in turn for him, we've ended up making a few tools that he's gotten to use. No one else really has. He's got a healthy graffiti imagination, too. We like him because he uses any material. He's good with spray paint, but he also has ideas for using human feces. There's no privileging any medium over any other. We created a tool for him called the High Rider, which is basically a new version of this Barry McGee style spray paint extension system.
The main difference being... resistor@hotmail.com email account from a man named Hype.
Turns out Hype does in fact work for the Office of the Chief Architect, who in the Netherlands is responsible for the 1% of all funds on projects over $200,000 that must be endowed to an arts organization to do a type of public artwork. They called me and I went outside to talk to him, and that was the first time they dropped a number, which was 30,000 euros. And it turned out, after some deliberation, that it was exactly that, that they would give us 30,000 euros, no strings attached. They would deposit it in a Dutch bank account that belonged to Theo Watson, who became our collaborator on this project, and said, come to Rotterdam, check it out, and then do something.
Software-wise, there's a lot of similarities. Graffiti analysis and laser tag. I wasn't thinking about graffiti analysis at all for some reason.
When you look in retrospect, it's all related to all the projection projects. Graffiti analysis and the drip sessions combined with the interactive architecture type software approach, it makes a lot of sense.
The main difference.
The proposal was all a farce. We would have won it no matter what we said, but we submitted to them three photoshopped images of a few buildings in this certain part of town called the Koop van Zuid, where we had scribbled with a fluorescent green brush tool GRL on a building and made it look like it came from a laser. Yeah, after we pitched the project, I found from researching where to purchase high-powered lasers that the Netherlands was the only country that restricted laser strengths to below 1 milliwatt. And of course, the ones we were planning to use at the time were 20, 40 milliwatts. We ended up using 60 milliwatt lasers. The Dutch government has a specifically strict policy regarding lasers, and no one's ever mentioned it to us. No one ever said anything. Yeah, they have some laws there, but there's kind of a loose hand enforcing them, which is what makes the Dutch people so fucking awesome. So anyway, we had this $30,000. IBM was actually getting some renovations, so we were kind of out of the lab, and we're working kind of remotely. So Evan kind of tested to see if the idea would work using processing, and then we were like, okay, it could. Now Theo, make the code. So when we actually got the money and started ordering equipment to test this out, we were like 2 weeks out from the event. So Theo really went to coding. We got all the equipment together and we head to Rotterdam with this idea and $30,000 worth of responsibility, and we had never tested it a single time. We had no idea it was going to happen. And in fact, in the days preceding the event, we were more worried about some stupid fucking ad in Boston than we were about, you know, whether or not we were going to be able to laser project on a 15-story building. Yeah, but that started us on our super pro look, Pelican case-wise. And now when we travel around, we look like some bad motherfuckers with these giant Pelican cases. So the first night we got there and set it up, it was just us out there in this parking lot. Rotterdam is a shitty place to be all year long, but it's particularly fucking rainy and horrible in February. So it was foggy, rainy, crappy. We're standing out in the rain, testing the system out, and we finally get like a prototype up that's working. You know, the first time we wrote a Free Birdovsky, or we wrote Free Bird, and that got posted on Boing Boing. It was getting some internet attention even before it happened. People were kind of salivating for it. It's this laser beam. It looks pretty cool. We had contacted before we left some graffiti writers in the Netherlands and told them, we're coming there with this system. It's going to be a tool for writers. Do you guys want to come and use it? And we happened to meet an organization called Catfight. And we met this woman. She writes Foxy Lady. And she runs a bunch of different female graffiti writer-oriented organizations. Another one's called BIC, Bitches in Control. And she's connected to the writers in the Netherlands, to a lot of them across a few cities. She contacted a lot of people for us and got them all excited about coming out, including some people from Berlin, a guy who writes Dask. We've never, in fact, duplicated that level of interest in the graffiti community in another city. It's something we should probably work a little harder at, because it did require a lot of front-end work getting in touch with them all, you know? Graffiti people aren't necessarily the most reliable. They all came out. They came out every day. They were there on the first day when we were setting up, just to test to see if it would work at all. And they, in a large part, were what made the project as successful as it was. On opening night, we had a bunch of riders out there. We turned it on with the laser tag system hooked up in the Himmermobile, which was a RV setup that Hybe had gotten for us from his uncle. It was hard to tell if this was going to be a good project or not, right? I mean, there's like 14 graffiti writers, really, really stoned, and they're all super excited about using it. And we were really happy seeing it actually work and come together and not look stupid, but look really fucking good. And they started feeding us suggestions like, oh, why don't you add a bevel tip? Can you guys make it where you can adjust the thickness of the stroke? And Theo was coding in real time, adding these in, including the drips. Theo went home that night, programmed him some more new brush additions. We came out the next night, all those graffiti writers came, and that pretty much continued for the next three nights. Every night we'd come out, improvements to the system, more footage, cops would come, people would use it. A good time was had. On that trip, we kind of rolled out with a pretty big crew. It was me and Evan, Bennett for Senate was there, and Theo. That's the first time we kind of really established a little bit of a block party vibe out of the Himmermobile, so we were rocking like Bennett's special mixes, drinking beers, and that profile has stuck with us now that we've managed to keep these kind of paramilitary party things going on. I'm sure people think that we're like some fucking schmucky sellouts because we go and do art events. But we go and stand out in the cold with a bunch of graffiti writers and do our shit. And the art world pays attention to it on some level. But for the most part, the audience for that initial event was just writers. We got to do permission and sort of non-permission stuff all over Rotterdam. And in the end, we came back with equipment that now we can give for free to anyone who wants to use it. When we got back, we put together the video. We knew the video was good the first time we watched it. Theo put up a really good website that had the entire instructions, set how to use the software, how to set up the equipment. He did a really, really good job on it. So when we released it, it had a really big impact. It is to date our biggest project. And it was received attention from counterculture type organizations like Art Threat or the 9/11 Truth Movement, all the way up to kind of mainstream bullshit like the David Letterman Show, and has afforded us a lot of opportunities subsequently. In New York City, we've done it in Brooklyn, we've done it in Hell's Kitchen, we've done it in downtown Manhattan, we've gone to Barcelona, pretty soon we're going to be doing it in Budapest and Mexico City and Hong Kong and Linz, Austria. We're adding functionality to it. We've put it on this mobile bike unit as well. It keeps popping up. But the advertisers got a hold of it as well. In the early days of laser tag, we got a lot of phone calls from people like General Electric and Walt Disney, and all these companies wanted us to write something for them. True to what we do, we said no to all these guys. Particularly fun to say no to Walt Disney. Particularly interesting to say no to a company like General Electric, who, as far as I know, probably have actual lasers that could ride on buildings. But at this point, these people have actually taken some of the initiative to put together the open source code on themselves. None of these major corporations have done it, but bands, video directors, someone who did like the stunt award ceremony. And there's another crew who have said they've deeply explored the sort of shallow software territory we started for them and are now doing something called Urban Graffiti Interactive Simulation, which involves laser tag on the side of cars while, like, models are flanked on either side of it with their hands out like they're on the fucking Wheel of Fortune. We make something, they steal something. This is the natural process. But in the meantime, there's a lot of people who are doing the laser tag setup in their garage, and you can find those now on Flickr and on YouTube, people who have put together their own laser tag setups, just normal guys, riders, hackers who are making these systems. In addition, we've used it here in the city for protest groups, just parties, in addition to getting some really legendary writers to use it. People like Leon Reed, people like KR have wrote with it, 323, Katsu, Hell, AV1, all the dudes that we work with and look up to and respect have all gone out with us with the bicycle and taken advantage of this as a graffiti tool and a public expression tool. We'd seen the effectiveness of dragging audio when we worked with Borf. He wanted to make an audio system that was mounted on a three-wheel tricycle, which we called the Borf Riot Bike. And we had used that and seen how effective it was. So when we went to Amsterdam, we saw these huge bikes. We thought, you know what, you can get audio in there. You could get projection systems in the front of it. We always kind of imagined it would be like the Hummer with the gun turret on top, where someone would sit in front kind of wielding the projector, pointing it around. Dude on the back riding and DJing the music. And we managed to get funding from the Lower Manhattan Cultural Council combined with funds from iBeam as part of like this show we did called Open City. It was a bunch of our friends and kind of our heroes who showed the tools they make in the iBeam gallery. We combined all the laser tag equipment and we kind of got this bike put together for us. So if it's free for us, we can make it free for everyone else to use, which is what we're doing now. Anyone who contacts us who wants to use it, other than advertisers, can. They come in, they get trained on the system. It's like a mobile cinema. You can go and play movies with audio. You can make your own content geared for certain types of building. The projector's really flexible. The system's pretty flexible. You can move it around into parks and things like that where cars couldn't go. We have no interest in curating the content on this, and we don't have endless amount of time, so we're trying to make a system that our interns can run and our collaborators can run, and that just individuals can get trained on and then go out and use without us having to be there. some other groups, truthmove.org, Electronic Intifada. We're really a shitty, small organization, just the 2, 3, 4 of us. But if you combine it with that crowd of people out there that we know are sick to death of ads, sick to death of control in their cities, don't understand the dualities, why that one class is subject to a set of rules that the other isn't, that there's just a world of people out there that could use these tools and will complete these projects if they're going to be completed, you know, and who, you know, who'll be spilling the blood in season 2 and you know, saying whatever the fuck they want to say. Season 2 begins with two things, right? The Summer of Blood and the Mobile Broadcast Unit. Just like the Laser Tag Project or the LED Throwy Project, both of them we need to create tools and application examples for those tools that make people want to buy into this and get involved. Already one in Barcelona, sponsored by Hangar. Yeah. You know, it looks like the legislation's going to go through, but if everything stays on track, we are going to be awarded the title of the Department of Homeland Graffiti here in the United States and can directly liaison with countries all over the world to help improve the graffiti there and to give more people opportunities to tear their cities apart.